Assalamu alaikum. Peace be upon you. This is the greeting you will hear throughout the whole Islamic world. Salam alaikum. Peace be upon you. I have titled this What I Have Learned About Islam, because I wouldn't presuppose at all to be, giving a lecture on Islam. I don't know that much. But what I have learned and what has been so valuable for me, I am just happy to be able to share, and thank you for being here. First of all, my clothing. This is pretty much the national dress of Pakistan, and you'll see it in India all the time also. A shalwar kameez, the baggy pants, the top with the splits on the side, and I have my head covered. Men and women in Pakistan wear essentially the same thing. But in Afghanistan, you'll see men wearing this, but the women usually are wearing the burqa. They're totally covered. In Somalia, the women wear long skirts. And there are a lot of Somalis in Minneapolis, and when I visit there, I notice the girls are wearing long skirts, but the tops are kind of tight, and I don't know how they do it, but they've got the sexiest flare at the bottom of those skirts that when they walk along the street. And I also noticed in Pakistan, even though women were dressed like this, they really went for shoes. And even in Afghanistan, where the women are totally covered, their shoes. And that's one of the clues they have when sometimes insurgents or the Taliban will be wearing a burqa so that they look like they may be a woman. Look at their feet. Those fancy shoes just aren't made in sizes that fit the men. Now, on my head, I do have my head covered. Some of my Muslim friends say, yes, you must do it. You must have your head covered. Others say no. A couple of years ago, I was at a wedding reception. Most beautiful hairdos you ever saw. And a lot of the women did not have their head covered. I'm being a little facetious when I say this, but it's kind of like if you're Lutheran, you don't have to wear a Norwegian sweater to church. Well, I lived in Africa for years, and the second place we lived, Moshi, was a larger community city. There was a mosque. We heard the call to prayer at 5 times a day. I was principal of a school. There were Muslim kids. I was aware of Ramadan, some of those things, but I didn't really know a whole lot about Islam. And then my son, Greg Mortensen, who wrote Three Cups of Tea, started working in Pakistan. And that's where I got my first real glimpse. He built one school, and after that school was built, there were a bunch of communities asking for a school there. And he thought, well, he knew how to raise money now and kind of how to go about it. He thought he'd do that. And a fatwa was issued against him that said he had to leave Pakistan at once. He was building schools, and he was an infidel. And he was building schools for girls, which was forbidden. So he went to Saeed Abbas Rizvi, who is the head Shia Ayatollah in Pakistan. Pakistan is about 75% Sunni, about 20% Shia. There is a small group of the followers of the Aga Khan and a very small Christian community. And as I say the Christian community, one thing I found that I thought the Quran forbids drinking of alcohol, but there are liquor stores in Islamabad. And if you are a Christian, and if you get a letter from your priest or pastor that you are attending services, you can go buy liquor at the liquor store, but the rest of the population can't. So you can imagine what some of those people have as a little side business. Well, anyway, this fatwa was issued against Greg, and he didn't know what to do. Should he leave? He really wanted to help these communities have a school. So he went to Saeed Abbas Rizvi and asked him, what should I do? And he said he would write to the head Ayatollahs and religious scholars in Qom, Iran, because Iran is rather the head of the Shia, and their head scholars and Ayatollahs are there. So he wrote to them, and Greg didn't hear, and he didn't hear, and after a long time, he was called into the inner part of the mosque. And he was sure that they would say he had to leave. And instead he was given a red velvet box, and inside was this beautifully written letter in the old style Persian. And this is what it said, translated into English. In the name of Allah, the merciful, the beneficial, dear compassionate of the poor, our faithful Saeed Abbas Rizvi, to provide guidance with your alms in northern Pakistan. We agree that the Holy Quran does not prohibit your work to promote girls' education in our homes. Our Holy Quran tells us that all children should receive education, including our daughters and sisters. Your noble work follows the highest principles of Islam, to tend the poor and the sick. Secondly, in the Holy Quran, there is no law to prohibit an infidel from providing assistance to our Muslim brothers and sisters. Furthermore, we direct all clerics in Pakistan to not interfere with your noble intentions. You have our permission, blessings, and prayers. May Almighty Allah guide you. So, all of this destroying schools, keeping girls out, is not Islamic. I don't know if it's even cultural, but if you want to have power, don't have people have education, and especially deny it to the women. The first word in the revelation to Muhammad in the Quran is Iqra, read. And I think that's very interesting because Muhammad was not literate. But the first word was Iqra. And then the first two chapters talk about how all people should seek knowledge and become knowledgeable. Well, that kind of, what is this all about? So I was looking more into, I hope I can get this up. I'm going to turn this off so we don't have the searching there. Oh, we're not searching. Yeah, I'm searching. Is
that scrambled out or?
I wanted it up. Everything's working. So the first pillar of Islam is the profession of faith. There is one God, and his prophet is Muhammad. Something I found in this book who speaks for Islam, I thought was very interesting. That anyone who believes in the one God is Muslim, according to the Muslims. And his prophet is Muhammad. Muhammad isn't the savior like Jesus, but that means they should follow the ways of Muhammad, just as a Christian should follow the ways of Jesus. So all prophets, they say, are Muslims. And they believe that prophets were sent to all people. But the people of the book, the Jews, the Christians, and the Muslims, are all to be respected. Great respect. There should be respect for both the Jews and the Christians. So again, when people are destroying Christian areas. And one commentator I read said, you know, that really started with the Crusades, that they learned how to do it from the Christians coming to drive the Jews and Muslims out of the Holy Land. Muslims recognize the biblical prophets and God's revelation to Moses and Jesus. Indeed, Moses, Isa, Jesus, and Miriam, Mary, are very common Muslim names. Mary is mentioned more often in the Quran than she is in the Bible. It is often in the context that when they mention Jesus, son of Mary, so the name will be that way often. And some of the Christians I've talked to in Pakistan say that's a way of saying that Jesus isn't the son of God, but just the son of Mary. The Hadith, which is a book of sayings, sometimes they say it's sayings of Muhammad, some say of his followers, but there's one I think is very, very interesting, and it says, when a baby is born, the baby cries, because at birth, Satan slaps it, and it makes the baby cry, and this is true of all babies except Jesus and his mother Mary. And Muhammad doesn't even have that distinction, which I think is quite interesting. And according to the Quran, there is diversity in belief, cultures, and traditions, and they think that's part of God's intended. Because if God so willed, he surely could have made everyone all community. So the first pillar of Islam is the profession of faith. There's but one God, and Muhammad is his prophet. Prayer. Pray five times a day. Sunrise, or right before sunrise. Noon, early evening, and when you go to bed. At the mosques, the call to prayer will be five times a day. In Corfe Village, the place, the first school that my son built was, at the evening call to prayer, which is at about 5 o'clock, the oldest boy in every family goes up to the rooftop, and when the call comes from the mosque, they echo it, and it's just a beautiful, beautiful thing to hear throughout that whole village, all these young boys' voices with the call to prayer. Five times a day, a lot of Muslims don't do it, but some of them do, and there's an incident in a book I read where a Muslim businessman was rather being made fun of by a friend of his. He said, five times a day, isn't that pretty often to be at prayer? And he said, well, how often do you eat every day? Breakfast, lunch, dinner, morning coffee, evening snack? That's five times a day. And he said, if your bodies need to be fed times a day, doesn't your soul need to be fed also? The next thing is the fast at Ramadan. And during the Olympics this year, hearing about some of those athletes that fasted. And fasting isn't just not eating food. It's not drinking. It's not swallowing your own saliva. So it's rather rigorous. And when the fast comes, the time of year it was this year, when days are long in the northern hemisphere, sometimes they will set a 12-hour so they don't have to have it from sunrise to sunset. But still, I think those athletes must have been under really quite a restraint to fast. A young woman from Pakistan who was going to Montana State University was asked what was the hardest thing for her to do as a Muslim. And she said, well, people were supportive, but she said fasting in the U.S. was hard. It's much easier in an Islamic country where everyone's doing it, where the restaurants are closed during the day and they open up in the evening. So she said that was the hardest thing. The fourth pillar of Islam is almsgiving. People who are following the prescribed, you add up all of your liquid assets, not just what you earn, not just your income, all of your illiquid assets, and then 2.5% you give. And this is not considered charity. It's not voluntary. This is something you do, and it's given to the poor and to the sick. And then the last pillar is the pilgrimage to Mecca, if you can do it. And the Arabic word for the journey is the Hajj. And if you meet anyone whose name is Haji, or they have Haji in their name, then you know they have made the pilgrimage to Mecca. Some of the things that suicide bombing. Suicide is forbidden in the Quran. It started, I don't want to call it a tradition, but suicide bombing started with the Hindu population of India, and there was quite a bit of it during the partition of India, in Pakistan and India, and the fighting they were having between each other. So that's forbidden. Killing of innocents is forbidden. Now, jihad was another thing I wanted to talk about. That word, in this country, I think we think of a holy war. Jihad is actually a struggle, but it's an inner struggle. It's a struggle of maybe what you should do, how you should live your life, but the word itself doesn't mean going to war. And I think in our popular conception of it, we've gotten to think, oh yeah, that means that going to war, maybe jihad is suicide bombing. But jihad is an inner struggle. There are passages that you can pull out of the Quran which would seem to say that holy wars are justified. But if you read the whole context, it doesn't say that at all. You can defend yourself, but there should be no wars of aggression and no killing of aggression. We hear about Sharia law and thinking of it, beheading people or stoning women who have committed adultery or things, but there, I was reading the Old Testament in Deuteronomy. You know there's a passage in Deuteronomy that says, if two men are fighting and the woman intercedes on behalf of her husband and grabs the other man's testicles, her hand should be cut off. We could say that the Bible prescribes that. And the same way some of the things in the Quran, but if you read the whole thing, that isn't what it's talking about. And one of the things I think has gotten to be very interesting in Afghanistan right now, in the Quran was one of the very first places that said, if a husband dies, his wife should inherit, not his brothers. And in much of the world, that has been the custom, that when a man dies, his brothers get everything, and if the brother will marry the widow, she at least has protection, her children will be with her. But if they don't want to marry the woman and if she can't go home, widows are often destitute in those countries. Right now in Afghanistan, the courts are clogged with women because as they have become literate and they've heard about this, they realize they can go to government courts or they can go to Sharia courts and they will inherit. So I don't want us to have Sharia law in this country, but there are some things that the rest of the world has learned from that in that time. I wanted to just, several books I've read, if you're interested. Lost History is a fascinating book, and it talks about the things that you've probably heard about, like algebra coming out of the Islamic world, how the library in Alexandria was the largest collection of books and things. It was destroyed when the Christians went into that area, they burned the library, but how they kept so many things alive. This is the best book I know of on the Taliban. It's Rashid, Ahmad Rashid's. It's before 9/11, but many, many men and boys went to Pakistan and lived in camps, and there were no women in those camps at all. So a lot of boys grew up in only a male society, and he believed some of the repression of women with the Taliban were, the guys were scared of them. They'd never seen any. They didn't have their mothers and their aunts. Who? So this is just a super book. And then Descent into Chaos, where he writes the United States and the failure of nation building in Pakistan. And then Out of Darkness into Light is a reflection on the Quran. Then two books that I have found really fascinating is one is Who Speaks for Islam. For 2 years, Gallup polls interviewed thousands of Muslims all over the world. And what we are hearing, like in our media, this is what they think. Yeah, it's just full of statistics. What do Muslims say about Western countries and their leaders? Unfavorable opinions of Western states vary. 90% of the politically radicalized and 62% of moderates express absolute dislike for George W. Bush. This was when they were doing it. 70% of the politically radicalized and 43% of moderates do not like former British Prime Minister Tony Blair at all. But when they asked about French and German leaders, there wasn't that much. And it's kind of interesting because France and Germany are two countries where Germany has this large Turkish population, which is underclass and looked down upon, and France has their whole North African, Algerian, which are, and yet they have a more favorable look than, say, America did. It's full of questions like that. I really thought that women were absolutely oppressed. I thought probably in Afghanistan one of the biggest things women wanted to do is to not wear burqas. Do you know what Greg has found out when he talks to women about the burqas? They feel safer in them. He has asked women, well, in both Pakistan and Afghanistan, what do you really want? You know, two main things? I want my babies not to die, and I want my children to go to school. Those are both so attainable. And these are Muslim women saying that. Well, I've talked long enough. I want you to get into groups. Shall we number off? Let's number off. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. We're going to have, we're going to go 5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1, 2, 3, 4. I've gotten you before, right? Mm-hmm. 4, 5. 1, 2, 3, 4. 4. You're knitting, but I'm calling you 4.
Okay.
Have I gotten you?
No.
5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1. Okay, 1's over here, 2's, 3's, 4's, and way back there, body. This book was written by a pastor, a rabbi, and a sheikh. All Americans. And it's the power of our own stories. And they believe we need to, if we're going to have interfaith dialogue, we need to tell our own stories. So to start with, we'll talk about Pastor Don, who is a Presbyterian pastor. In his journey to interfaith, he describes his experience of being born into privilege. How do you relate to the issue of privilege in your own life? Do you feel as if you are an insider, or do you experience yourself on the outside looking in? So if you would talk about that in your groups, or maybe when do you feel like you're an insider, and when do you feel like you're an outsider? Okay, I'm going to stop you here. We've been talking about privilege in our own lives in different ways. But then, have there been special moments in your own life when you have become aware of the suffering of others? Would you share that? Not your own suffering, but are there moments you've been become aware of the suffering of others?
And I'm very aware.
Well, in as a product of the 60s,
a Western tour.
Great.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to stop you at this now so we can go on to the next part. But Pastor Don was asked to sum up in a single verse or a single story that reflect the essential teaching of Christianity. Can you guess what word he may have chosen and which verse? Love.
Yeah.
This is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you. Well, what did Sheikh Jamal say? I'm going to have you, before I tell the word, he shared his very special relationship with his parents. They were major teachers for him on his spiritual path. How have your parents influenced you on your own spiritual path? Are you following in their footsteps, or have you set out on your own? How has this affected your relationship with your parents?
Are you going to tell us the word?
No, you have to stop first, and I'll tell you the word afterwards.
You make us hang out there, huh?
That's what you know.
Sheikh Jamal said that until 9/11, he had never experienced discrimination as a Muslim, but he did experience discrimination as a person of color. And an aside with that, I have a good Pakistani friend who said she really didn't feel any discrimination. Occasionally people would ask her, she's a physicist, why are you living in the United States? You know, why aren't you in Pakistan where your country needs you? And she said, we came to the United States for the same reason your ancestors did, to give our children a better life. But she said until 9/11, she didn't feel much. She says, now I never go out the door without realizing I'm a Muslim. Mm-hmm. And that was just 2 years ago. Never goes out the door. So, how have you been aware of discrimination in your own life? And you know, this recent bombing of the Sikh temple in Wisconsin, because they thought they were Muslims. And even in the paper, so much is talking about these people weren't Muslims, rather than saying no one should be. It was like, if they were Muslims, it would be understandable or permissible, but since they weren't, and that's the sense I got from the media, rather than this shouldn't be done to anyone. Anyway, have you been aware of discrimination in your own life? And have you been able to, your experience to sensitize you to the experience of others?
A lot of people
think
it would
be a
After 9/11, when Sheikh Jamal was feeling this, he still felt this closeness to God, to Allah. And he was reading the Quran over and over, and he came often across the word Rahman. It occurs more than 200 times in the Holy Book. And this word is compassion. He got the unmistakable message that compassion is not only a primary quality of God, it is God's very essence. So what he found through this, what was his word? And Pastor Don's?
Love.
Compassion.
What, and I'm going to say a few other things, but the main thing I have learned about Islam is that I need to know more about Christianity. I need to know God more. I need to know Jesus more as I walk in that path so I can understand others. My brother has a friend who is an imam, and he said, when I am talking to a Christian congregation, I say God. In the mosque, I say Allah, and when I'm singing Latin, I say Deo. He said, it's all the same person. I recently, well, not that recent, I guess, heard a talk by one of the religion professors at Gustavus Adolphus. He is Muslim, and I have some very dear but very conservative Lutheran friends who think it is a travesty that a Muslim is teaching in the religion department at Gustavus. But he was talking about, he thinks the big hope for Islam is America. Because women who wear a shalwar kameez and women who wear a burqa and people who think jihad is this inner struggle, or people who think jihad is destroying others, they're all together in the same place. So the Indonesians and the Egyptians and the Pakistanis are together, they're talking to each other, and they're seeing so much which they have seen as Islam, is culture. My brothers will inherit mine, not my widow. That's definitely in the Pashtun, but not necessarily in Indonesia. And so he says he thinks the big hope for Islam is America, and I think we need to help in that, and we can help by dialogue that way. So, in 1 minute, talk about the one thing you want to share from your group, and then we'll share it with the whole group. All right, sorry. Why don't you stand
group
up
one.
So everybody...
We were number one.
We're the ones, and I don't have the words exactly correct, but in the prayer of St. Francis of Assisi, talks about how I wish to understand and not necessarily be understood. I need to understand. Good. We need to understand.
That's almost what
we're doing. I'll take it. So we talked about...
Why don't you stand up? Then they can all hear you.
Oh, I'm a teacher. You would have heard me. But at any rate, I'll stand up. We were talking about where we came from and why, in this group, we think that we have been blessed, and that we have had lots of opportunities that other people in other parts of the world have not had, and we don't understand why. But we would like to be able to express, if you will, allow me to use the word, compassion to people that don't have as much as we do. And I guess our goal would be to be able to try to do that in some way, in some probably really small way, but that's what we've been talking about.
Can I put one minute order here? Our word was understand. That we thought that at least we were understanding one another, and that we're open to change, that it's coming, and that we're not sure about the compassion, but we want the love there. But understanding is important.
We sort of were talking, I was talking certainly, about how as Christians we're going to help our Muslim neighbors for their discussion within the faith, since we're outsiders to the faith. How do we find our role?
So we have much the same thought. I think, I mean, we're not finished, but we felt that you have to respect and love your neighbor if you're going to make progress.
And we are the quarter after. Thank you so much. Can we have one more other prayer? Dear God of love and compassion, help us to live in both and show both love and compassion to others. As Christians, we pray in Jesus' name.
Amen.
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 Thank you very much.